Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I'm Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net.
We are recording this on a school night, a weeknight, instead of our usual Friday, so no wine discussion.
No wine discussion, but I showed up and you were still drinking champagne, though, Charlie.
What, it's Thursday. You don't drink champagne on Thursday?
Not typically, but I must confess that you were not expecting my arrival.
We do not need to get into the logistics behind the podcast.
No, but just in case we go off the rails, I want everyone to know why.
You have reason to gloat this week because you put in a lot of work.
I did.
A lot more work than I did.
Indeed.
In fact, you saw the two biggest releases.
Mm-hmm.
I did not. But nope. I think we determined this week's biggest release looks like, from what I can see, a political comedy starring Seth Rogen and Charlize Theron. Is Long Shot worth any shot at all?
Well, this is the one that had the most buzz. It actually had a lot of buzz coming out of South by Southwest. And so my expectations for it were perhaps a little too high, because while I think it's okay, especially if you like Seth Rogen comedies, I found some of it a little sophomoric and irresponsible. Which was a shame because it starts off incredibly strong with all these very timely themes. You have Charlize Theron, who's an Academy Award-winning dramatic actress.
From Monster.
Playing, you know, a comedy role up alongside Seth Rogen, who, you know, has done things like Pineapple Express and The End of the World. And so it's this interesting, weird mishmash of Seth Rogen comedy, but with some smarts. And when it's being smart, it's very funny. When it's not smart, it's pretty gross. And so you have Charlize Theron playing the U.S. Secretary of State, and she's this very poised, smart, beautiful woman, and she's in line to run for president because the current president, who is very Trump-like, has decided that he's going to aim higher and he's not going to run for re-election because he wants to get into movies. And so immediately, you know, you're kind of feeling that current run through. And then Seth Rogen is this journalist, very schlubby guy wearing this sort of 80s neon tracksuit all the time, who is very committed to his profession, but has no filter and is basically a bit of a troublemaker. And he ends up quitting his job because his newspaper has been taken over by this media mogul who looks a heck of a lot like, is portrayed to be sort of like a Rupert Murdoch kind of character. And so the Seth Rogen character is like, you know, his ideals are too high and lofty, and he is not going to stick around and work for this this media mogul, who actually is played by Andy Serkis, who is completely unrecognizable
role. We saw Andy Serkis. Like, usually he's Gollum or he's sitting behind some green screen,
yeah.
But we did actually see him in Black Panther.
Yeah, we did, but this one, you see him, but you don't know it's him.
Mm.
He's under so much makeup and just completely unrecognizable. And he doesn't have a huge role, but this movie, it's called The Long Shot because the two of them end up sort of romantically linked, and she is so far out of his league, you would think. But she's been told by her advisors that, you know, she's not funny enough. And in this world of style over substance, if you want to run, the polls are showing that you're not funny enough to win election. So you need to hire a speechwriter to sort of punch up your speeches. And much to their chagrin, she picks this Seth Rogen character. And that's how, and it turns out that she had been his babysitter back when he was a kid. And so he'd been crushing on her ever since for decades. But they reunite because they're both at this event with a Boys to Men mini concert going on, and they bond over that. This movie was just uneven to me. There were moments of brilliance and just really sharp satire and good stuff. And then there's your typical drug stuff. Like, I have a problem. Maybe I'm just getting too old, but there is something to me not funny about a Secretary of State who has to resolve a international crisis while she's still high on ecstasy. And that's sort of one of the types of things that goes on. So typical Seth Rogen fare just kind of mashed together with this attempt to be a smart political romantic comedy.
Is the Charlize Theron Secretary of State any resemblance or homage to Tay Leone's Madam Secretary?
Madam Secretary. Initially, that's who I felt that it was being modeled after. I really like that show. But Seth Rogen has no resemblance to Tim Daly, who plays her husband on Madam Secretary. And their relationship is, they are much better suited to each other on that show. And you would not find her, popping pills and trying ecstasy on a night that she then has to, solve a world conflict. If it had been more like Madam Secretary, I would have been completely on board. But instead, it just kind of went off the rails for me a little bit. And it's such a long shot to see these two together. And I wasn't really buying it because, you still would expect her to then say to the dude, like, really, you gotta change up your wardrobe here if you're gonna go to state dinners and things like that. And maybe I shouldn't be, doing drugs with you just for fun or for old time's sake. So I didn't buy into it as much as the 20-somethings that were sitting around me in the theater who absolutely did seem to enjoy it. So to sort of keep the sports analogy thing in play, I would say that Long Shot kind of hits the rim, but doesn't quite make it through the net.
Fair enough. There seems to be a run of kids' movies lately. 2-3 weeks ago, it was Missing Link, which I saw, and then 1-2 weeks ago, it was a Disney Nature documentary, Penguins. Now, you went to see the latest one. I do not believe it is Disney or anything like that. It's called Ugly Dolls. I did see the trailer for this one because I'm going to guess it's like Warner Brothers. But Ugly Dolls is
that
a terrible...
STX or whatever that company is.
It's a terrible title, but maybe it's not. Maybe it's fitting. Maybe the dolls aren't so ugly.
It's fitting. No, they are ugly, but they embrace their ugliness. They live in Uglyville.
So it's okay to be an individual.
So it's okay to be ugly. Like, ugly's not a bad thing because they don't know any better. So ugly is just any other word. And I was really scared because I got to this screening and there were no other press people there at all. Not a one. Even the marketing person was gone by the time I walked out of the theater, so she didn't even stick around to get my opinion. And so I went into this with the lowest expectations imaginable. And fortunately, it wasn't that bad. It's superficial. It's very simple in its story, because it really is just about these sort of doll rejects that end up sort of, put down a sewer pipe and end up forming their own little community. And up above is this Institute of Perfection, where all the really perfect dolls come kicking out of. And all of their goals is to get out into the big world where you might find a child that can embrace you and love you. And so that's every doll's dream, is to get to the big world. But for the ugly dolls, they are kind of relegated to this other space. But they decide, this one doll, Moxie, and it's very literal. All the names are very literal. So there's Moxie has Moxie. And she is determined to, find out how you get to the big world. And she doesn't know that she's an ugly doll. But so she is voiced by Kelly Clarkson, who has a great voice. So when she's singing, it's really actually quite good. Janelle Monáe has a role as this you know, near perfect doll who has to hide the fact that she needs glasses because that would sort of preclude her from getting into the big world. And she becomes sort of an ally of the ugly dogs. Janelle Monáe can act and sing, so her role is good. And one of the Jonas brothers, I think it's Nick Jonas, is also in this. And he plays this perfectly coiffed doll named Lou, who kind of is in charge of all the other perfect dolls. And, you know, he's pretty well cast. But then you have Blake Shelton is voicing one of these characters. And maybe if they had had him singing and it was, like, really good, then he would have understood why he was in this. But his delivery is just terrible. So it's not painful to watch. It's only like 83 minutes long. You got a couple of catchy tunes. It's for the younger kids, but it's you probably would have liked it more than Dumbo.
It's not hard to do.
Exactly. So, you know, it's a let your freak flag fly, celebrate your differences, very well-meaning message, very forgettable, but, you know, it goes down pretty easy. So you won't remember it. It's not going to be nominated for anything other than maybe get some songs, you know, into the mix later. But, you know, and Kelly Clarkson actually sang the song that's the big song over the end credits about being, you know, being beautiful or not being beautiful, but that's okay. And she sang that on the American Music Awards, and everybody just was sort of embracing the themes there. So, you know, not nearly as bad as I feared.
I have no follow-up questions, because honestly, I don't care.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's and that's exactly it, is if you have a little kid and you need to take them to something, and you like all the fact that there are all these singers who are making up the cast, because you also have Pitbull and then Gabriel Iglesias, and Wanda Sykes has a very recognizable voice in this one. But I can't like tell anybody they need to go run out and see it, because that it's, you know, like the best animated adventure movie that you'll see. I put it below Wonder Park, which, you know, came out a few weeks back. Harmless.
All right, now I can play.
Yes.
We have three left, and of course, I saw the indie, the documentary, and the foreign film.
Of course. And I saw the ones that people actually have heard of.
Let's start with the indie, The White Crow. And we are very familiar with the director, Ralph Fiennes. Mm-hmm. And if you've already forgotten, this is not his first feature film. It's his third. His first was in 2011 when he directed Coriolanus, a Shakespeare adaptation. And in 2014, he was Charles Dickens in The Invisible Woman, a movie I quite highly enjoyed. Now it's The White Crow. And I did not know this. Ralph Fiennes is in love with Russia. He's in love with Russian history. He speaks Russian. He's a god in Russia, because people know that Ralph Fiennes like Russia. So right on. And he made a movie based on a true story about Rudolf Nureyev. The only thing I knew about Rudolf Nureyev is like a trivia question answer. Who was the male who is the male ballet dancer? Blah. Rudolf Nureyev.
Yeah, or it would be Mikhail Baryshnikov, who I always got Baryshnikov and Nureyev kind of confused because they both defected.
I did not know Nureyev defective. I didn't know anything about him. I didn't know in 1961 he went on a tour of Western Europe from Leningrad, discovered Paris, and realized he couldn't leave Paris for a number of reasons. So this is the crux of it. If you don't know this story like me, you would enjoy it probably more than you who knew this story already. Ralph Fiennes did a very good idea. He could have either hired an actor and taught him to dance, or hired a dancer and taught him to act. And he hired a dancer and taught him to act. He hired Ukrainian dancer Oleg Ivanko, I believe. And I don't know my first position for my arabesque. I don't know if he's a great dancer. I think he is. It looked really hard.
Oh yeah,
what he
he's a world class dancer. He truly is in real life. But I would disagree with you that I think it was a tough call. Do you hire a dancer or do you hire an actor? To me, this guy couldn't act. I had a hard time with his acting because I felt like he only had one look, and it was this sort of brooding face throughout the entire time. And so to me, I immediately was wondering whether or not this guy was had any acting experience whatsoever, and he didn't. And if there had been the opportunity for more actual ballet dancing in this film, then I would have understood the choice a lot more. But I read that they really couldn't do all that much. It's very choreographed, very complicated, very costly to shoot. And so there is not nearly as much actual dancing in this film as I would have liked, because I loved it when I'm watching the dance. But during the scenes where you were really supposed to believe what was going on acting-wise, I wasn't. And I thought the chronology, I didn't like the way the story was told. It jumps around between the time and the locations, and I did not like that.
I agree and disagree with that. I disagree because I enjoyed the three-part structure. We see his early childhood way out there in like borderline Siberia in the 40s. We see him learning to dance in Leningrad in the mid to late 50s, and then we see him 1961 Paris. I love bouncing around, but I did not love the editing. It didn't work. Yeah. All of a sudden we're here, now we're here, and they did not wrap up his childhood. I have no idea what happened.
No.
I don't have a clue how he got from Ufa, which is way in the middle of nowhere, to Leningrad at the time. I did like the locations. You mentioned it was expensive because they got to Leningrad. They shot inside the Hermitage and outside to give you that St. Petersburg feel. They got to Paris and shot in the Louvre and had him actually in front of this painting that was so blindsided him so much that he had to sit and stare at it. I loved his French friends a lot. I enjoyed the scenes more than the dancing because I don't know anything about ballet.
Oh, see, and I just, I love the dancing. I thought the narrative was so choppy. And you talk about that's probably, you know, maybe part of the editing process. But I did feel that the story was ultimately incomplete and unsatisfying to me. So that could have partly been because you do discover that Nureyev, while he was a brilliant dancer, not technically brilliant, but very free-spirited and was independent in his movement and was going to dance his own way. And so his defection really wasn't about politics so much as it was just about being able to, you know, to really show his expression and be free on the dance scene. I did discover, and you learn that he was not all that likable of a guy.
No, and I think
he was complicated. Fiennes,
maybe that affected the actor's performance. Fiennes had him play very brusque and extremely narcissistic, and just had this chip on his shoulder. He was very rude to people,
annoying.
It's possible Nureyev was like that in real life because he interviewed all these people, including Clara Sant, who is still alive.
That's amazing.
It's probably it's really close to the truth.
Yeah, no, I believe it is. But that sort of takes away when you're trying to watch what is this sort of biopic with the dancing. The fact that he was not all that likable, to me, made the choppiness of the narrative even worse. It's fascinating to learn about the woman in Paris who really helped him defect. And her role. And, you know, I just, I'm curious. I think back, I got a little bit confused sometimes when you think about Baryshnikov versus Nureyev. Baryshnikov was later, but I remember seeing Baryshnikov act in a movie called White Knights. And with, I think, Against All Odds is actually the theme song from that movie. And so Baryshnikov was able to do both. And so I'm not sure that you wouldn't be able to have found somebody that could be a slightly better actor in addition to doing the dance. So that's my only real criticism of that the story doesn't quite fit well, and I would have liked to see a more to understand more from the childhood through the end that we see. But I do like that we got to kind of meet the Parisian woman along the way who really helped get him out.
No, I'm just, I had no idea that this story existed, so I'm glad I ran into it. In fact, I'll go ahead, credit where credit's due. I'm glad you made me watch it.
Well, and I think Ralph Fiennes, it was definitely one of his, a labor of love film for him. And I think he originally did not want to be in it, but he is in it as one of Nureyev's dance instructors. And I truly believe that if Fiennes hadn't been willing to be in it in some capacity, this film never would have gotten made. And so he had to sort of make that concession that, okay, he'll take a role in this movie so that it would get financed and actually get distributed. And I think anybody who does like dance, who is a fan of ballet history, will actually enjoy this potentially more than those who aren't.
Well, the only thing I could really compare it to is probably our most recent ballet movie. You remember Paulina?
Yes.
Watched that last year?
Yes.
Totally, you know, different tones.
Reminded me a little of that.
But I honestly couldn't tell you which one I enjoyed more or not. But I don't know, this is just a good story. Yeah, and I love the fact that it's also true.
Yeah, I like that it's a true story and I learned more about it, but I would have actually liked the story to have been told a little better and maybe had a better actor.
So we got to take a field trip this week.
Mm-hmm.
We went downtown on Monday night to the Naval Heritage Museum, which is in the Penn Quarter, if you know D.C., down by the National Archives. And we saw a new Netflix documentary. It's already out on Netflix. It was released on Wednesday. You can go watch it right now after you hear this review.
And it's in theaters as well.
Yeah, it is in a handful
Some
of
select,
art house.
Like select theaters.
Like in D.C., it's on E Street, I believe.
Yes.
But it's called Knock Down the House. And director Rachel Lierz noticed a lot of women who were angry after the 2016 election decided, hey, why can't I run if a reality show guy can run and win the presidency by losing by 3 million votes? Then I can run for Congress, or I can run for Senate, or I'm going to primary this guy, this incumbent, who hasn't had a primary challenger in 14 years, which is what Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez did. Out of the four, she is obviously number one. Not only because she won, but because she was based in New York, and editing-wise, it had to be her. And then there are three others who, biggest fault of the film, they're known as the three others. One's
right.
In Vegas, one's in St. Louis, Ferguson area, and one's in West Virginia taking on Senator Joe Manchin. She got lucky. You mentioned it on Monday. Director Rachel Lierz got lucky. If Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez did not win, this probably could still have been something, but not what it is.
Mm-hmm.
What it is actually a study of power. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was not supposed to win, but you actually see how, for the first time, if you haven't been paying attention, how she did it from grassroots, not taking any outside money, going to a debate where the guy didn't show up, going to the community events, interacting with people. You see how, you see her playbook, which is fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
You see her unexpectedly win on a victory night. And then since it's a study of power, it doesn't matter. She's just one of 435 representatives. She really shouldn't have any power, but she was given power by Fox News. They gave her pretty much 4 million Twitter followers by making her a lightning rod. They made her someone to blame for that half, and they made her a hero for that half, which is why this film, for me, while not great, is really good, because I knew of her. I knew why she was famous, but I didn't know how she did it.
No, I agree, because I certainly had, she's a social media phenom. You know, people know her as AOC, mostly because you can't always remember what the three, what her three names are. So I always am like, oh, you know, that Cortez Alexandria person. So I was really glad to kind of discover exactly who she was and where she came from, and learning that she was a waitress, and you know, she really came out of nowhere, and she was propped up there. The film also explores this grassroots organization that was saying, you know, we are going to find everyday heroes who are willing to just go out there and challenge these incumbents, regardless of party. That, you know, it's not about Democrat versus Republican. It's about the political machine and the power that is granted to incumbents, and the fact that they kind of lose sight of the little people, the constituents that they're supposed to be serving, and just sort of get elected automatically now. And so this was all about just sort of finding these everyday hero women to just step up and say, you know, we're going to fight the good fight. And one of the benefits of us going to these kinds of events, this was the DC premiere of this documentary, is while AOC didn't show up, which we were certainly hoping she would.
They said there'd be a guest. And people were like, oh my God, it's going to be AOC.
Yeah, we were thinking she might pop up. But the director was there along with one of the women, Amy Villela, who was out of Nevada. And she had a very compelling story. It's like her 22-year-old daughter died when she, by something that should have been treatable in a hospital, but she was denied treatment because she did not have health insurance. And so Villela has really just gone out there to fight for Medicare for All is basically her platform. And to see this woman and to see how committed she is to making a difference, I don't think we've seen or heard the last of her. The other two women, Cori Bush and Paula Jean Swearingen. I'm not so sure we'll see as much of them, but Amy Villela looks like she's going to still be on the scene in the future and just kind of rallying still for improvements in healthcare and healthcare coverage for everyone. And so she had a very powerful emotional story that I appreciated more after seeing her and hearing her, because she really, you just felt that she is just one of those people who was going to just put herself out there knowing that she had virtually no chance of winning. And with all of these women, including AOC, they come to realize that, if for 100 of us are going to have to run for one to hopefully make it through and win, and AOC just happened to be that one that really broke through, it doesn't hurt, though, that she is incredibly attractive and smart and seems to know her stuff. She's only 29 now, and you just know that that she could potentially be on the scene in politics for many, many years to come.
AOC is not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. She is whip smart. She was so ready at these debates. She was nervous beforehand, but she saw her doing her preparation, and she eviscerated decades of experience with her opponents. Amy, who you're talking about, is definitely the second lead because of her story. The other two really get lost.
Yeah.
You could tell this Rachel Lears was New York-based. She had no money to shoot this film, so you could honestly see she made two trips to Vegas, two trips to West Virginia, and two trips to Ferguson. Mm-hmm. And it really comes across that. But you could see she was hanging around AOC in the Bronx and Queens. And that comes through in the editing, and editing is skewed in AOC's favor just because she had no choice.
Sure.
It's a broader mesh of power. It's, colon subtitle AOC's story, though. Rachel Lears got lucky to produce the first documentary, probably many more to come.
Yeah, I kind of felt like it could have easily become or been an AOC documentary in and of itself. And so she probably has enough footage to be used down the line to create yet another documentary strictly on her. But I think what really drove them was the realization that 2016 showed them that they're, all bets are off with the whole political system, and that nothing's predictable in politics anymore. And so, it's very inspiring. It's like, just, go for it. You got nothing to lose, because we've learned that anything can happen.
Yeah, well said.
I would point out that you can go to knockdownthehouse.com, and there you actually can find out where this is playing. In addition to being on Netflix, but also they've got this interesting thing going where they've got guidance for how you can have sort of a screening party at your own house. And I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, they do. I saw one you didn't see.
Yes.
And it's called Long Day's Journey into Night. Kind of a confusing title because it's a very famous Eugene O'Neill play. And it has a different title in China where it came out. And man, did the Chinese people get so mad at this movie. They got so mad at this movie because false advertising. New Year's Eve, they see this awesome trailer. It's got this sci-fi synth music. It looks like this film noir romance with a whole bunch of violence in it. And the movie is especially timed to end at midnight. So experience it with your significant other and then kiss the ring of the new year. What an amazing thing. And it was called Last Evening on Earth. Who would you want to spend the last evening on Earth with? And then they saw this movie. No. This is a pure art house slog. It is, I found it challenging, and I am good at these movies. It's boring. It's straight up boring. People were so mad, and they took to social media and tore this thing apart. However, yes, it's not for the mainstream fare. It's for me.
Yeah.
It's for me.
It is.
The first half is, it's mostly film noir. It's a guy remembering his past, remembering the dame who got away, and he's looking for her. He's going to his old places, his old haunts. He's exploring memories, exploring the thinnest of hints and threads where she is. And then the second half is what the movie is known for. It turns into 3D, and it's called a 59-minute take. That means a single shot with no edits. Nowadays, in a movie, the average shot length is 5.5 seconds, and then boom, edit, something else, a different point of view. In action movies, that can get down to like 2 seconds in, say, a Transformers film. Director B. Gone did a...
that is your real name?
Yeah, B. Gone. B. Gone.
Director B. Gone.
Did a 59-minute take. A 59-minute take. And it moved. It went all around and through a town, and the choreography was there. You could see the preparation that went in this. And that's the only reason people like me are going to go see this, because we heard about this. It goes from 2D into 3D in a 59-minute take. So it's like, sign me up. I'm in. I want to see what he did. It's not a gimmick, but I can't tell you, did he do it to be purely for artistic reasons because he had to do it? Or did he do it to gain notoriety as the guy who did the 59-minute take?
It may not be a gimmick, but it's certainly being sold that way. And I remember just seeing the blurb about it, and all it said, it really focused on the fact that, oh, you have to see this film for this extra long single take that's just phenomenal. And it explains why you really don't hear much else about the movie and what the other half of it might entail. And so, yeah, I figured I'd leave it to you to slog through it, and I'm glad that there are some folks out there who might appreciate what it's trying to do artistically.
It is gorgeous. I mean, he went through 3 cinematographers, and it really is drop-dead gorgeous. Both the 3D and the non-3D. I actually preferred the non-3D myself, because, you know, he could actually move around and do things and edit. But there's a lot I didn't understand. There's a lot of things I had to fill in, and I think it's on purpose. I'm pretty sure the 3D part didn't happen, or if it did, it was a fever dream. It's very confusing. You gotta want it. You can't take your date, your significant other, on New Year's Eve to this movie. This is pure art house catnip.
Okay. I'll take your word for it.
But I'm not gushing over it. But it is, man, it is drop dead gorgeous.
Okay.
All right. Anything we want to look ahead to next week?
No, I would say next week's just really tough because there's quite a bit coming out. You have Pokemon Detective Pikachu with Ryan Reynolds. And so that's got, Ryan Reynolds has appeal to me. Then you've got Tolkien with Nicholas Hoult. I love watching Nicholas Hoult. You've got Palms, a cheerleading squad at a retirement community film with Diane Keaton and Jackie Weaver.
No, thank you.
I know, but movie for grown-ups,
for
sure.
It reminds me of last year's book club.
It does. I think that's exactly who the target audience would be. The Hustle, very strange here that we really kind of had to keep pushing to find out if it was even going to screen for the press. And now there is one screening, but it conflicts with Palms. And
actually, that's a good tweet. You should tell Hannah to either tell her to go see Palms or The Hustle, because she's conflicted.
I'm totally conflicted. So which do I choose? Because The Hustle has Rebel Wilson and Anne Hathaway, and they play con women. It's like a remake of Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. So that has a certain appeal, certainly chick flicky in what it's offering. And then there's this other one, Wine Country, that is launching strictly on Netflix. That's Amy Poehler and Maya Rudolph. And so I'm kind of thinking, you know, the two of them should be able to develop something fun for me. So I don't know what I'm going to see out of all of these. But yes, if you have a preference for whether I see Palms or The Hustle, please let me know. Whereas Charlie,
I'm going the indie route. I want to see Molly Shannon as Emily Dickinson exploring her alternative lifestyle in Wild Nights with Emily.
Yes.
And a movie called Dog Man which is all I know because I didn't peek at what it was about.
He's a dog lover, and there's some weirdness that goes on in his life. But Artie Chick for ChickFlix.net actually already looked at reviewed Dog Man, and the other Emily Dickinson one she's going to review. And so, yeah, we are going on two very separate paths.
No, I'm
going to
meet
films.
You in the middle. I'm going to go see Pikachu.
Okay. Good enough.
All right. Quick recap. Long shot.
If you like Seth Rogen comedies, I would say go back and watch 50/50 by the same director, which was one of my favorite movies of 2011. Otherwise, yeah, this is definitely going to be one where the South by Southwest demographic seem to embrace it more than I think the rest of the general public will.
Ugly Dolls.
Couple of catchy tunes. Beyond that, you just sit through 80 minutes and then it's over and you leave and you'll never remember having seen it.
I really appreciated The White Crow for teaching me a story that you don't learn in history class. It's good stuff.
I love the dancing. I was not thrilled with the acting.
Knock Down the House is a very effective documentary because it's about power. It's not about AOC.
And girl power.
But it stumbled into success because AOC happened to win.
Yeah, I'm glad we saw it.
I can't call it the best film of the week. It's the most interesting film of the week. The 59-minute long take, Long Journey's Day, whatever.
Whatever that long slog you were.
One of you
about
out there can do it. I know you can. One of you out there.
Yeah, maybe our listener, either Christian Hammaker, maybe, or...
I know he's intrigued. He's tweeting about it.
Or Brett could Sun and Shine out in New York. Maybe he'd go for it. So if anyone does see that one...
Yeah, it's like a cinematic dare.
Yeah, it's a cinematic dare out there, so go for it.
All right. Well, thank you very much for listening to this episode of The Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl. Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.